During my lifetime, I have been several things: a Catholic, a devoutly anti-organized religion atheist, and a Unitarian Universalist. But there's only one thing I have always been and will always be: a science fiction geek. As Joss Whedon put it, I'm a science fiction geek from birth. That's just who I am. I have been a science fiction geek for as long as I can remember, at least since my parents let me stay up late and watch Star Trek when it first aired in 1966. So it's all their fault. Even before the Starship Enterprise embarked on its 5-year mission, my favorite book was The Little Prince. Imagine a child who had a flower, a fox, a snake, an aviator, and all manner of exotic folks as friends and teachers. Some of these friends and teachers even lived on asteroids, and none of them talked down to the little prince. This was a message of hope to my little self. Maybe there were grown-ups out there who would take me seriously. I still hope that there are grown-ups out there who will take me seriously. The worlds opened up for me by The Little Prince and Star Trek fed my imagination and curiosity, and they laid the foundation for what has fed my soul my whole life long. Along the way, I have found that some strange new worlds are liberating, some are frightening, some are challenging, some are an escape from reality, particularly valuable during personal crises, and some are wrong turns. But they all had something to teach me. Though the effect of these strange new worlds may vary on those who encounter them, the one thing they all have in common is that, even though they might take place wholly or partly on Earth, they have one or more elements that are just unfamiliar enough to jar us out of the here and now and place us in the there and then. At bottom, science fiction is all about what it means to be human. During the early December worship that Rev Charlotte and Ellen Badgley shared, Rev Charlotte quoted writer Ed Simon, who writes that the photo from the Event Horizon Telescope is of the place where physics falls apart, where logic shall have no dominion, where seemingly unassailable kingdoms of time and space are finally conquered, where mathematics fails and something else must take hold. And they continued, that something else is our ever so human need to find meaning in those situations. For all of our rationality, it is through awe-inspiring, direct experience that our spirits are renewed. Spiritual and religious experiences require meaning-making of that ether known as wonder. I would add that science fiction storytellers, screenwriters, and directors have been making meaning out of awe combined with a heavy dose of everyday direct experience since at least Jules Verne, and arguably since the first storyteller earned their supper around a prehistoric campfire. Ellen Badgley showed us a NASA black hole safety video, but writers and readers of science fiction can apply hand wavium to just about anything and explore all of creation and more in our faster than light, black hole impervious, God inventing imaginations. As Octavia Butler said, science fiction frees you to go any place and examine anything. In preparing for this service, I pulled out my old laptop and went looking for a class I'd taken in seminary called On Other Worlds. It was taught by then-recent Star King graduates Aize Jama Everett and Justin K. Waters. Required reading included Dune by Frank Herbert, Dahlgren by Samuel R. Delaney, and Oryx and Crake by Margaret Atwood. Required viewing included Star Trek First Contact, District 9, and Metropolis. Unfortunately, the class was early enough during my studies that I hadn't yet developed the habit of writing my weekly reflections in Word and then copying them to the online sharing site. I can't access the sharing site anymore, so I have no record of what I thought about what we were reading and watching on Other Worlds. What I did find, though, is my 2010 application to Starr King School for the Ministry. At that time, the school asked applicants, among other things, to name five writings, films, or artistic works that have influenced you and explain how they have helped shape your life. I'd like to share with you excerpts of what I wrote almost 10 years ago. I adore science fiction, and so my influences are mainly in that genre. I believe that science fiction allows us to examine, discuss, and perhaps resolve issues that, were we to confront them without the guise of another place, time, and space, would be insurmountable. And the first work that I cited was The Hyperion Saga by Dan Simmons. The books in the Hyperion Saga are Hyperion, Fall of Hyperion, Endymion, and Rise of Endymion. In them, Simmons explores what it means to be human and what we humans mean to our silicone creations when they finally attain sentience. Each character in Simmons' universe, as in ours, is unique, but we all find a livelihood, profession, or calling that defines us as much as, or more than, we define it. In addition to exploring what makes us human, Simmons looks at what it means to be a diplomat, an artist, a warrior, a scholar, father, and Jew, a Catholic missionary, or any human with a religious calling, a detective, and a lover. Through his beautifully written characters, the author argues with God, shows us the code of the Bushindo, gently exposes betrayal, shocks us with fear, and reminds us that, in the end, we face demons of our own creation alone. Faith and religion are also characters in the Hyperion Saga. In the future, Simmons argues, these two characters will continue their now the same, now different dance. Faith remains pure, while religions are human organizations founded in faith that, like all human organizations, are subject to corruption, intrigue, power grabs, and all of the negative human baggage. As such, religions are capable of corrupting faith. My favorite character in the Hyperion Saga is Saul, the Jewish scholar and troubled father. Before I read his arguments with God, I thought I was the only one who thought that God was a bully and who argued with him, even though I didn't believe in him. Saul asked God why he asked Abraham to sacrifice his only son. I'd always thought that had been a cruel thing for God to do. Saul accuses God of demanding the sacrifice of the parent during the Holocaust and finally tells God, enough. There will be no more sacrifice, neither of child nor of parent. The Hyperion Saga was my gentle reintroduction to theology. I reread it when I feel the need of grounding and refounding spiritual curiosity. Like all works of art I enjoy, Hyperion makes me think. The second work that I cited was The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood. And at that time, remember, the Hulu series had not come out yet. The Handmaid's Tale was my introduction to Canadian author Margaret Atwood. We Americans often joke that Canadians are just Americans who live in a colder place with national health care. We can't see how truly different we are, and Atwood shows us. With an outsider's perspective, she shows us what the United States might look like in a not too distant, polluted future after a second American Revolution where a theocracy, the Republic of Gilead, has taken the place of our treasured democracy. Of Fred, the heroine of the tale, is a young woman valued only for her ability to conceive and bear children. Her pre-revolution life was filled to bursting with a husband, daughter, friends, and a career. After the revolution, she becomes a handmaid, a vessel only, and her days are filled with quiet in her little attic room. She looks forward to a daily shopping trip with another handmaid and dreads the ceremony, a prescribed perversion of intimacy designed to get her pregnant and thus fulfill her destiny. The Handmaid's Tale got me thinking about the purpose of sex and marriage. Was that purpose procreation, as I'd been taught in Catholic school? If so, Atwood exposed what could happen if the sacrament of marriage is taken to a logical, if not feasible, conclusion. Of Fred began her pre-Gilead relationship with her husband in an affair. He was married at the time. He divorced and they married and had a daughter. After the second American Revolution, he became unnecessary and was killed so that his daughter could be adopted by proper people and his wife could bear more children for proper people. After reading this novel, I became more certain than ever that sex and marriage are not just for procreation. The world is already overpopulated, so we should be thinking about having fewer children, not more. From this realization, it was but a small step to begin working for marriage equality. If we remove procreation as the reason for marriage, then there is no reason left to deny same-sex couples the right to marry. I attended my first gay pride parade in June of 1993 and have been marching ever since. In 2006, Virginians voted on a marriage amendment to our Constitution. With many other people at Brew, I rallied, phoned, and campaigned against the amendment. Unfortunately, we lost that battle, but I believe that marriage equality will become a reality in my lifetime. It has. The next work that I cited was Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. I feel really icky including this book in my application for seminary. But Atlas Shrugged was a big influence on my late teens and early 20s. I read it at the recommendation of two other girls I met at the American Legion Pennsylvania Girls State in 1976, between my junior and senior years in high school. Atlas Shrugged opened up a whole new world of thought for me. Until I read it, I had no idea that there were other ways of thinking, entirely different philosophies, and ways of looking at life than I'd learned in my 12 years in the diocesan Catholic school system. Unfortunately, I bought Rand's philosophy wholesale. I'd buy anything wholesale that opened my eyes the way this book did. The virtue of selfishness cost me friends and narrowed my view of the world just as I was getting ready to go to college to expand my mind. Reading Atlas Shrugged at this time in my life was a perfect storm of anything other than Catholic and ideas that were new to me. When I was a junior in college, I took an honors course called The Economics of the Great Depression. The class was taught by a monetarist and further fed my feeling of rightness. I bought into monetarism as well. I didn't begin to change my mind about objectivism until my father died suddenly during the last semester at the University of Delaware. If it were not for Social Security, something reviled and despised by good objectivists and conservatives everywhere, I could not have finished my degree. Maybe there was something to the Great Society after all. Atlas Shrugged was a negative influence on my life. It sent me down the wrong path for years. Without it, though, I don't think I would be so entirely convinced that both objectivism as a philosophy and monetarism as economic theory are so wrong. The final work of science fiction that I cited was Blade Runner, directed by Ridley Scott. Like the Hyperion saga, Blade Runner explores what it means to be human. Los Angeles in 2019 is a sad place where it is always dark and rainy. Anyone with any sense and without disease has gone off-world, leaving the Earth populated by the sick and poor on the one hand, and by the fantastically wealthy on the other hand. Earth itself has become so polluted that animals are rare and human nostalgia for them has created a whole new industry creating imitations. The Terrell Corporation has gone to the limit and created replicants. More human than human is their motto. Replicants are created to be used by off-world humans as surrogate warriors, assassins, laborers, and prostitutes. They are created as adults with a built-in lifespan of 4 years and no memories. They are forbidden to come to Earth. We're not sure why, but it is hinted that replicants are not happy with their lot in life and have tried rebellion in the past. At the beginning of the movie, it is revealed that 4 replicants have come to Earth from off-world. It becomes the job of Rick Deckard, a Blade Runner, to retire them. In the course of exposition, Deckard visits the head of the Terrell Corporation and discovers that Terrell's niece is also a replicant, a new kind. She was built with memories leading up to her pre-incept life. Does Deckard now have 4 replicants to retire, or 5? There are many things that I love about this 1982 film. One of them is that there are so many versions of it. There were sneak preview versions I'd love to see, but which have been lost or locked away. I saw the original widely released version of Blade Runner in the theater in 1982. The first version released on VHS was the European theater version. It contains much more violence than the Blade Runner I saw in the theater. The director's cut came out in 1992 and replaced the happy ending of the earlier version with one of uncertainty. Ridley Scott's final cut was released in 2007 and hints that Deckard too may be a replicant. There are 2 quotes from Blade Runner that have stayed with me over the years. Roy Batty, the leader of the replicants who have come back to Earth to confront Terrell and demand more life, has both. Batty confronts the scientist who makes replicant eyes, saying, "If only you could see what I've seen with your eyes." Just before his death, Batty says, "I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I've watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gates. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain. Time to die." It's a wonderful twist that a replicant has the 2 most memorable lines from this thought-provoking film. Here, I'll repeat something I said about Dan Simmons' Hyperion. In the future, faith and religion will continue their now the same, now different dance. Faith remains pure, while religions are human organizations founded in faith that, like all human organizations, are subject to corruption, intrigue, power grabs, and all of the negative human baggage. Science fiction is also a human endeavor. Like religion in opposition to faith, the strange new worlds that so intrigue us and shape our thinking are the works of people who sometimes are extremely flawed. As stated in Cory Doctorow's essay, the creators of Strange New Worlds are far from perfect. Joseph Campbell was a fascist and a eugenicist. It's also well known in science fiction circles that Isaac Asimov groped women at conventions. And Gene Roddenberry, creator of my own personal favorite future from the time I was 5 years old, was a well-known misogynist who maintained a casting couch. Strange New Worlds themselves also are not perfect. Though I loved them all, which version of Blade Runner is the true one? The one I saw in the theater in Dallas in 1982, the VHS version I bought in the 1990s, or several of the DVD versions I purchased later? Or was it maybe the preview version, which few people have ever seen? Even future histories can be revised. I watched Star Trek: First Contact in the theater when it was first released in 1996. When Captain Picard dreamed of Earth as taken over by the Borg Collective, the camera zoomed in on New York City skyline, specifically on the World Trade Center. When we watched First Contact in 2013 during the On Other Worlds class, the more recent DVD edition had been edited to remove the Twin Towers. Fiction about the future had been changed to match a past reality that had yet to exist. The fact that I could not find anything about this after about an hour of internet search disturbs me. We dwell in a world where science fiction is quickly becoming science fact, though it's a good idea to avoid black holes in real life in the foreseeable future. As with our science fiction heroes, versions of the stories we adore and reality as portrayed in our favorite universe are not all they appear to be. How do we know the truth? Amen. Namaste. Blessed be.